We're going to go ahead and get started for the agenda this afternoon. How are we recording? First up, what I'd like to do is take a quick moment to introduce our new city administrator, Steve Reimer. You want to raise your hand? And I'm sure a lot of folks will get to know Steve in the coming weeks and months, so we're happy to have you.
I'm happy to be here, so thank you.
All right, thank you. So let's get started. First up, we have the Mayo's MCC Arena update. And Joe or Brad, who's going to cue this up?
Yeah, we can both come up.
We're starting off with an easy one.
Yeah.
And you might introduce yourself, especially for the benefit of Steve.
I just got done meeting him, so.
Yeah. All right.
Probably more than he needs to know, to be honest with you.
All right. We'll see if he stays the whole meeting.
Yeah,
we're so far. The fact is he introduced himself and he stayed.
All right, go ahead.
So I know you have a busy agenda, so I'll get right to it. I made some bullet points, and I'll read off that. That way I don't talk too long. As you know, in recent interest from investors and new possible long-term arena tenants have led us to the ongoing exploration of a replacement strategy for the Taylor Arena within the Mayo Civic Center complex. The time is right for Rochester to support this type of private-public investment. We know that this project would benefit our community economically and culturally. Rochester has the opportunity to draw in major long-term sports tenants that can provide the basis for a sustainable business plan for the arena itself. A recent study conducted by PricewaterhouseCoopers shows that Rochester can support 6,500 to an 8,000 seat modern multi-purpose sport and entertainment arena complex to replace the aging Taylor Arena. Recruitment of the future workforce is imperative to our community and can offer a high, attractive, quality, affordable entertainment, arts, sports events, and an arena is estimated to generate more than $4 million of new increment spending in Rochester annually. Please support the formation of an arena task force as our new city administrator has outlined so we can solicit proposals from private developers and groups that can help us to be successful in this development of this operation. And I'll stop there.
All right. Brad?
Yeah, Brad Jones, Executive Director of the Convention and Visitors Bureau. I'm the lucky fellow that's been working on this, mainly for the last couple years. We forwarded you a community impact study that was conducted by, as Joe said, PwC, which shows the new incremental spending potential for Rochester, both economic and fiscal impacts for the MSA and the state. Of Minnesota as a result of the development and operation of a new arena. A broader study was also conducted and has been completed for us by PwC. This provides the appropriate information for a market-based commentary regarding demand for entertainment, indoor special events, and sports activity. The study estimates the potential utilization between 128 and 159 events per year, with a worst-case operating result of $260,000 net profit a year and the best case of a $1.46 million net profit at the end of a year. The broader PwC study also provides us with valuable commentary on considerations related to successful operating models, capital funding, and financing plans. The results from this broader study contains confidential proprietary work that can be used in our task force or work group. We would not ask the city and taxpayers to bear the cost of an arena alone. We have several strategic, successful public-private models that have worked in other communities that we've researched and that we can explore here. We have engaged with potential naming rights and foundation-level sponsors, as well as private developers, and several new arena user groups and tenants that are willing to make long-term commitments. And when I say long-term, I mean more than 15-year commitments to Rochester. So we welcome the opportunity to join a work group to further explore the specific details of a new arena and what that can offer in terms of diverse array of affordable entertainment, culture, arts, special events for our city, and also be an economic generator for our city. So, glad to answer any questions for you, but I'll stop there and
all right. That. All right, thank you, gentlemen. So, who's first? Questions, comments? Don't be shy, Mr. Mayor.
I was just at Quarterbacks Club today, good noon, on Monday, and as you know, I'm probably one of the younger people there, so you can guess the group. One of the questions that came up, I didn't do a straw vote to know, but the majority of that group are from the old school and really don't want to see things change there in a nutshell. Question though is, how will this impact the current uses and future uses of Taylor Arena? And some of that is specifically for the various high school tournaments that are held there,
yeah.
Not only Rochester, but this whole region.
Great question. We've built into the sustained operating year a model around what occurs there today. And this enhancement, namely the new arena, the full bowl seating and amenities that come with that, to augment that. So in our model, we would sustain everything that we do today and add the new to it. So you would have two or more full-time long-term tenants that would put their activities into it. But we would retain those things that we do now. Commonly, Mayor, how these work in a building is the city or the operating entity maintains a calendar, and they book the events into that calendar, and then they release them at a certain point to an arena, and then they would fill around that. So commonly, that cutoff point is about 14 months in advance. You book everything you can. For instance, if we had a large convention that had to use it, we would book that into it, so those dates would come off the calendar. And then we would turn it over to an operation, and they could book all their tenant activity, all their concert activity, and everything around that. So commonly, that's how that works. So we would take our legacy clients and events with us into that calendar.
Mr. Bilderback.
Couple questions. Number one, what's the timetable you're looking at?
We don't have a specific timetable, although the clock is ticking for some of these tenants. They would like to see this move along. I guess in an ideal world, we'd like to see probably something in a 19-20 season, but it doesn't have to be. I think they're just looking for some action to start here in the forthcoming future. I think the window of construction we've learned is about a 16-month construction period, 16 to 17-month construction period. So you can kind of work from there based on that window.
And this is a suggested committee, a size of committee?
We've had some ideas. We talked at the Mayo Civic Center Commission about who should maybe be represented. I think Mr. Reimer had some thoughts, which are all very good, and we'd be willing and able to participate, but you know, that would be up to you on who should be part of that group, and I think the most important thing is we need a process to engage the private sector here, and we need a process to bring their proposals to light, and I think you'll be pleasantly surprised at what people will help us be successful with.
And Brad, how would that be communicated back to the council? I think the fact is this would be something that we want pretty transparent.
Yep.
So my question then is, how often, what would be the frequency that you'd be coming back to speak to us?
Well, first of all, I think they should be public meetings. They should be under the auspices of the city. You're the owner of the facility, so I would propose that they're very transparent and public, in a public setting. So, I think there's some things that we've had to work through and engage people with. But I think it's to a point now where it's a public process.
And would they be making multiple options of funding? I mean, I think funding is going to, who's paying for it and who's controlling is going to be huge. So are they going to be come back with more than one, multiple options? What is your thoughts?
Yeah, if you've got a good process, I think you allow for creativity as well. So I think at least what other cities have done is you engage partners that are in this business and they bring you ideas on what can be done in your city and with your particular asset. So I would foresee that every one of those brought forth would be a little bit different.
And naming rights, have you looked to see what potential
we certainly have.
Money has could be brought in on naming rights?
Yeah, we've been in the market for a year.
A little over a year.
And we're very confident that we have the partners necessary to make this successful.
Thank you. Mr. Woodruff.
In making the decision as to whether or not to go forward, we should all be cognizant of the fact that staff has limited bandwidth and there's only so many issues that can be addressed, and we as a body must determine what the priority issues are for the community of Rochester. I first of all would not be doing my job if I did not first put on the record, as we go through this discussion and any votes related to this, will there be any council members who will be recusing themselves from the discussion and voting? So the audio record will show that there are no council members that will be recusing themselves from discussion and voting on this. The next item, you mentioned that we would be the owner of the facility.
We are.
You have to be. Yeah.
Okay. That's set. My question for staff is that to do any sort of bonding, my understanding is that that will require 5 votes of the council, a supermajority, to issue those bonds.
It's not in the charter, so maybe Dale would know.
I did not think so, but I don't know that for sure. I'd have to look.
Additionally, is a referendum required to issue bonds for this? Because it doesn't fall under the auspices of other parts.
I don't believe so. Dale, referendum?
You might.
I have a feeling it depends on your funding sources. If your funding, if your mix of funding sources are things other than city general bonds, then you probably don't. If it's geo bonds, you probably do.
Okay. It sounds to me that we have some additional questions then that need to be answered. I've got some more questions, but I'll let someone else take a stab.
Mr. Campion.
Well, at the risk of being called old school, which I heard the mayor say, and you guys will have to forgive my voice, fighting a little bit of a cold, I kind of want to talk about some of my concerns about this. So having just invested about $70 million into the facility, one thing that always concerns me is you don't try and add a deck to a house you're currently building. And there's good reason for that. Things can happen. You can be caught off guard by surprises on what balance sheets look like, what the level of the deck needs to be when you finish the house. And so I look at this and I go, are we tacking something on to a new facility? We don't fully understand the operational expenses, the draw, the magnetism for it. And there's a few, you know, parts of this argument that always concern me. I've seen a lot of these failures. They're well documented, but additionally, the demand for this isn't new in my mind. Like, I think it was my first council meeting I came in here, and we had the exact same discussion about whether we should pursue a hockey arena. So this idea that there's some sort of critical crisis we're facing and we need to make a decision now is a little bit of part of what gets foisted on communities when they have this decision. And it only gets worse once you have the hockey arena. That's really my fear. Once you have the hockey arena, you have no more leverage because now you have to have a tenant. You have to have someone in there. The team, the ownership, they have all that leverage. So I'm not a no never here, but when I look at it and I look at the priorities for the city and I look at what we've already made as investment, What I'd really like to see is 2 or 3 years worth of successful operation of the existing facility with the new expansion before considering throwing additional variables into this. I don't believe for a second that the demand for minor league hockey or the demand for NBA G Leagues or whatever it's going to be, what's after G, H League is going to be next year. But there's going to be some demand for these hockey arenas because they keep coming up. They've come up since I've been on the council. I'm sure they came up before then. I'm sure they'll come up once I'm done. But the nature of it is I think anytime we're ready, we're going to find partners out there that are willing to participate, especially as we move through the Destination Medical Center project that's drawing all sorts of focus in on our community. So I really don't want the council to feel that this is, we have to move now, otherwise we're going to miss the boat on an opportunity. I just do not find that to be materialized in any of the debate I've seen nationwide. Any community that's willing to lay out a map for one of these organizations and work with them is going to find willing recipients. We've been out there. We've found willing recipients. It's clear that you've done that. I just don't think the timing is right. I'd really like to see some more focus put back on the financial operation of the Mayo Civic Center and make sure we're on a successful footing before we look to add additional variables to that. That would be my principal concern with what's being proposed here.
Mr. Hickey.
Yeah, so as this moves forward, I mean, I'm certainly willing to continue the discussion and see what comes ahead. But the question I'll ask, you know, this, just like all projects we do, is I'm going to really want to, you know, details of where this has been done in similar sized cities and done successfully, and, you know, what were they able to do and how did they put it together. And, you know, I, not to sound like a broken record, but I talk about, you know, I don't, you know, getting away from the hypotheticals. You know, if this is a good idea, it's been done someplace else in a similar sized city, and really want to see that track record and you know, build off those kinds of successes.
I've heard it said a couple times, everybody refers to this as a hockey arena. The intent is not just for hockey, is that correct?
That's correct. That's one use. It can be converted to basketball, it can be converted to turf, it can be converted to a flat trade show. Actually, the trade show floor that we use now on Taylor Arena is somewhat pie-shaped. The new reconfiguration would make it a square, and it would add about 10,000 square feet, so it gives you about 10,000 more square feet of floor space, and it squares it off, which ultimately makes it more usable. So you'd be able to play a multitude of sports there, and then it could host a multitude of concert configurations. You can do end stage, you can do center stage, you can do Broadway, you can do a lot of different things that we're a little bit limited with today. The other vision that has been dreamed of, and we've got some costs on such a thing because there are a few of these around the country now, is an operable wall that can be opened into the park. So the arena could be opened into the park, and you could put your entertainment undercover and have more modern amenities for that, and they can play into the park. The advantage of that also is you can do many special events that are both outside and inside as well. So there's a lot of ideas in enhancing that location and enhancing the park into the facility as well. But to your point, hockey's just one of many uses that would be proposed.
You talked about park, and I think it's important to talk, many people have talked about that the green space in the park would go away. Can you address that?
Yeah, the preliminary folks that have looked at it have said that you don't need to go any further into the park. You can accomplish what you need to on the existing footprint. There might be a small amount of squaring off or something, but the intent, at least thus far, and the direction has been that anything that was to be built would be built in the current infrastructure.
And I would like to take Mr. Hickey's statement a little further. Not only do I want to see facilities that have been successful, I want to see those that haven't, that have been built in the same era, so we can kind of look at, see what worked, what didn't work, and why. I think that's important. I don't want to jump feet first into the pool here. I want to make sure that we dip our toe a little time. I'm not saying I'm supportive of it, but I think we need to cover all bases.
Yeah, and I mean, I do want to make one statement. This was brought to the Convention Visitors Bureau. We are in the business of visitor experience within the Rochester area itself. I sit on the board, okay, and that's why I'm here today. And it was brought to us. We put a lot of time into this along the way. There has been very little city staff. Gary has helped us quite a bit, but other than that, and that's more on the understanding all the different models of formula of funding this. But otherwise, we've pretty much done it all on ourselves. And it's come to the point where that's why I came here today and asked you to put together a task force. A lot of the questions that you're answering, those people can answer, and then at that point, they can report to you and come back, and then you can make a decision on where you would like to go and what you would like to do. But right now, we do not have a model where especially the private sector feels comfortable in coming forth and giving their full details of plans. Some of the plans that have been presented to me are extremely worth listening to. And I understand this is a new venture for the city of Rochester to do a public and private venture, but that also can be substantially beneficial to the taxpayers of our community, the fact that we don't have to go and get the money from them. And there are funding models out there where we could do this through the sales tax itself, too. I'm not saying that's the way to do it. Again, the task force would decide that on what the models are and how you would go forth. But a lot of the questions you're asking, I think this task force could answer.
So I have Ms. Johnson next, but before we do that, the chair of the MCC commission is here. I just wanted to give you an opportunity, if there was any comments. I know you put a letter in our packet of support from the commission. Any additional comments you'd like to make in addition to it?
Well, essentially when this came before the commission, we either endorsed it nor did we shoot it down. We felt kind of the same way some of you in the council feel. We have a lot of questions that need to be answered before we would support something like this. And I think the task force is the best way to go about this. But that's predicated on whether or not the council decides this whole project has merit.
All right, thank you. Ms. Johnson.
My concern, and I'm guessing the task force can answer this too, is about entertainment. Because we just had a proposal in front of us recently that proposed to bring entertainment here, and that was conversations about how that was in conflict with radius contracts that artists have, as well as some other proposed ventures that we have going on. So my concern is if we want to bring in entertainment, we're looking at those barriers as well. It's just a venue that, or an avenue that could be shut down pretty quickly, or has been shut down in the past. So that's the concern moving forward.
Yeah, this, I've learned a lot about entertainment in the last 2 years, more than I ever wanted to know. And there's a lot of considerations about entertainment and bringing entertainment in. I can tell you that the size of arena that we studied and that could be sustainable here is not going to attract tier one entertainment. So the Taylor Swifts of the world, at least not in the next 10 years, she's probably not going to come to an arena like this. But there is a level of entertainment that's very sustainable. You need to have the right infrastructure. You need to have the right relationships with those acts. And then you need to have the bargaining power and the ability to book those and strike the right deals. And so we have some of that information I can share with you. And I think the projections that they put in place for that model are very responsible. They're not saying they're going to bring 100 of those a year, but the number of which that they project are, I think, very responsible. So,
Mr. Rojic.
So, number more questions. A couple of questions directed to staff. Paul, you've been working very hard on a public on a parks master plan. In terms of facility needs for the cities, is this even cracking anywhere near the top of the list?
Sports facilities are part of our system plan, but not an indoor arena.
Okay. And the question for planning director Mitzi Baker. Sorry, Mitzi. One of the things that we carefully looked at in the process of doing some outreach for the comprehensive plan, which is in progress, was where people valued the putting their dollars. And one of the options included potentially placing a stadium in there, which is obviously a big cash draw in terms of public resources. If I recall correctly, the public pretty overwhelmingly didn't choose that option. Is that how you recall it?
It's a recollection, but I'd rather the facts.
Okay.
Check the data before I confirm
it. Well, we can certainly follow up with the confirmation of that. I do have some questions about, there's been a lot of alluding to proprietary data, things that people have seen, models that people have seen. So the study was funded by Mayo Clinic, is that correct?
They sponsored the study, that's correct.
So, and what I don't understand, this goes back to the question about the whole public versus private, but you know, you've acknowledged that you've spent about a quarter of your time for the last couple of years working on this. And the understanding that we got from the city attorney, though, is that because publicly funded resources are going towards this plan, that would make the plan public realm data then? Is that, are you suggesting that it's not public realm data?
No, the agreement that we have, at least on the one broader report from PwC, is that's a confidential, contains proprietary information for them. We would be able to use it internally and in a work group fashion. So we'd have to get some clarification on that, but you know, he was here and presented that to our board, and but I can get some clarification.
Well, and
on
we need
how
to get,
we can use that and how we can.
We do need to get that clarification, because I believe because the public resources of the RCBB has been used towards it, it's becomes public data as a result of that. So we certainly need to get some clarification, and that's something that's easy to do. Gary, they mentioned that you had helped out quite a bit. What's been your role in this?
Our office's role and Dale's role has been primarily, we met with PwC on one or two occasions that they ask us what are some potential revenue streams the city has, and we just laid that information out for them. That's been mainly our role in this. I would say it's actually been fairly limited. From my perspective, we know the council has been kind of split on this, and we wanted to make sure that when this thing comes forward, we would be able to give you an opinion that was objective, and for that reason, we probably stayed out of it more, but do you want me to expound further?
I do want you to list the possible revenue options that you've laid out.
Well, I don't know that we didn't give them an exact listing of revenues. They just basically asked us for, you know, some certain things. I mean, obviously, naming rights is one revenue, mm-hmm. and if you can get revenues from, you know, some of the teams that invest in it, that's another option. And those are mainly the ones we focused on. I do think, you know, in this whole thing, there are some revenue streams that people have for these type of facilities that are different from the kinds of revenue streams, for example, lodging tax kind of things of that nature. I'm not saying a new lodging tax, that fund these that don't fund things like park facilities, like Paul mentioned. I mean, there are different revenue streams in some communities that we've seen some of the evidence of PwC that go for this that are not the kind of things that take away from other city functions.
I wanted to drill down into the same footprint and specifically ask, does that mean the existing footprint of the building itself is maintained? Understanding you said some possible squaring off or something like that. But does that mean the actual footprint of the building, or possibly some of the hardscape that's on the exterior of the building, is it legitimately where the building ends today?
I don't know what they meant by that. I could presume they meant both of those things. So I think you know, once you start getting into architectural type phases, you could really drill down on that.
Well,
that's what they told me in the preliminary work, is everything could occur within the current footprint.
And I think that's something that's particularly of interest to me, because I have a long-standing, not an inch of green space policy lost downtown, and I'm pretty passionate about that. I wanted to drill down on the cost. It was just under $60 million, I think, is the numbers that I saw put out there. And
it depends on the size that you would go on. There are a couple different scenarios. Of course, the lesser number of seats you go in, that you put in, it would cost you on the entertainment side. The more seats you went on, that's what a promoter calls revenue potential. Mm-hmm. So the sports tenants, I can tell you, have both projected their average crowds of around 3,000 to 3,300, some nights maybe 4,000. So they like playing in full arenas, not cavernous arenas. So I think the size is pretty comparable to our market.
And then is that at least the figure that's been bounced around, is that an all-in figure? Does that include the site prep, the demolition of the existing Taylor Arena as well? So reported in the media on the exact same day were wildly varying ideas in terms of what the public participation in this would be, and all of the quotes were attributed to you. So one of the quotes was that the majority would be paid for by private parties. Another quote was hopefully half of it would be paid for by private parties. What is the realistic range that we see for public investment in the new stadium?
We don't know yet. That's why I think we need this task force. Is we need a group to really engage with those parties and bring those actual proposals back. Right now we're dealing in hyperbole. We're dealing in projection. So without actually going through that that process, you know, we can guess all we want. I'm just saying what other models have brought to bear, and I could see us getting in that neighborhood. But again, it's just a guess. That's why we need to take this a little bit further and engage with them officially, and you know, bring some actual proposals to the table.
I wanted to follow up a little bit on some of Mr. Campion's points about checking where we are in terms of the existing facility, because we have a major capital improvement that's gone on there. And my understanding is the Mayo Civic Center Commission either this week or sometime soon is going to be receiving some updates on booking performance on into the future. And our representative on the RCVB, it would be Hugh President Staver, is there... I've heard concern that our pace for future years is substantially behind where it needs to be, and even further behind from where it was projected to be with the expansion. Have you seen any numbers that would indicate that at this point?
There are monthly reports issued to the board that show tracking using a number of metrics: sales, both the facilities contracts, pending leads, and generally speaking, they're on track.
They're on track
with what we were hoping to see.
Okay, if they're on track, that's fabulous news. I would concur that I think we need to verify some of these numbers. Certainly going forward. One of my bigger concerns is that finite resources, and as soon as we go down the task force path, I think it's critically important that that data be public information throughout, and that means. But that also means that some of these things that, you know, are potentially proprietary, I don't think so, but maybe they are, that's probably got to come to light, at least the portions that would apply to the arena. And I'm also concerned that we got to square away what the requirements are to actually put a project like this forward. My belief is that it's likely requirements would include a referendum and five votes for a five-sevenths vote for capital financing. And if there's clearly not that level of support there, that's something that we should know ahead of time as well. My last thought on this is we've got a lot of big issues in front of the community. And we got a lot of things that we don't have money to fund. We have no path forward on library space. Affordable housing is in crisis, and we haven't even created a task force on affordable housing. Transit, there's big needs that are up in the air, and we don't necessarily have a path forward on that either. Road maintenance, which we're going to talk about later, represents more than $1 billion in unfunded liability. A number of big issues in the community, and a stadium is nice. A stadium is nice, but if there's not the level of support, and if we're willing to say that this is a community priority and that there's sufficient support there, five votes on the council to proceed with something like this, I'm okay with digging into it. If there's not that level of support, I think we owe it to our staff to make them more efficient to quickly make a decision that not at this time.
So in the interest of time, we're going to try to wrap this up, because obviously a lot of good questions, and I think that's the big question on the table is whether to form a group to actually delve into those details. But with that in mind, Mr. Ruska, then Mr. Goldeback.
Yeah, I'm not going to be long with my comments, but I think that, you know, one of the things that we're learning in this whole process, we don't have we talk a lot about public-private partnerships, and yet we don't really have a way to welcome it in our community. And I think it's an option that we really want to pursue. So, you know, with an arena that's 33 years old, is this the top priority? I don't know. But I think that this task force, the scope that's here seems really reasonable. And it seems a way that we can understand and learn from public-private partnerships and what they can do for the community and how they work a little bit better, and maybe how we can welcome them a little bit more into the future. So, you know, my question in looking at this is, you know, there's the scope here, there's additional questions. I think those are all fair. With this task force, how are we going to determine who that is and who selects those? Because I think that's a relevant point, too. I'm fine with, and I think we should be open meeting for anybody there, and that, you know, there should be a public way for questions and so on. But how are we going to determine who the members are on this, and is this the right makeup of that committee?
All right. Mr. Bill, back to Mr. Warrior.
Gary, quick question. Since we've had state funds put into the Civic Center, is there issues with funding based on the fact that we have some state obligation?
There is one issue, and that's the basically you need the state to say it's reasonable to knock down the old arena and replace it with one of X value. It's a valuation question, and basically that's a decision that would need to be made by the Minnesota Department of Management and Budget, which I've advised Brad of that quite a while ago. That would be a step that would have to be crossed. I don't know if that's something they've gone through very often, but you know, obviously at some point, some of the buildings where they put money into, they really haven't put any money into that building, but they put it into the complex. You know, people eventually, buildings age, you take them down, and there may have been state funding, and so I'm sure they've crossed that bridge at one point, and we need to ask them to tell us what the way to do it in this case would be.
I would just suggest, as you mentioned, with time being a consideration, that we potentially place this, whether or not to proceed with a committee like this, on the next regular council as an RCA, and we can vote on it at that point. And people obviously have some opportunity based on this discussion to give us their feedback as well.
And I think it was on the agenda. It was tabled, so it'll come back, or could come back anyway, for that formal action.
Yeah. The attorney's office give us an answer as to the 5-7 vote by that time.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Any final comments?
Just the rest of the council would agree that if it requires a 5-7 and we don't have 5-7 in support of the task force,
if
funding this effort requires 5-7 council members and there are not 5 council members that would agree to fund it. We did the same thing with the broadband initiative. We kind of said, listen, in the end, there's not going to be the council members to vote for this regardless, so why do the study, even if we're tilting on it?
And my only reservation to committing to that is because I think it would depend on what revenue source you use. Some revenue streams might require that sort of supermajority vote, others might not.
Yeah, I'd like to get some clarity.
I think we'd have to lay that out for you, but I think that's the case.
Yeah, I think that would be the correct thing to do.
Okay. No. All right. All right, so we can hopefully take it up and render a decision at our next council meeting. All good? All right, thank you.
See, I told you it'd be easy.
All right, our next item. St. Mary's Place, Public Realm Design Concepts. I'm not sure who's leading off on this one.
Patrick from
Mr. Sieb.
Dave. The other thing to do is we do need an answer on whether a referendum is required. I got it written.
Yeah, we have a
referendum's the other question.
All right. Is it Patrick? You're going to step us through this?
Yes.
And once again, I would encourage our presenters to introduce themselves for the benefit of our new city administrator.
Welcome. We are going to fire up this presentation, and I think you have materials in your packet that
we do.
I will be referencing. So while we're doing that, why don't I get started? Steve, welcome. My name is Patrick Seed. We've met before. I'm with Destination Medical Center, and I am here to provide an update to City Council and the Mayor on the work that we have been doing with respect to St. Mary's Place. I'm joined by Andy Masterpole and Mark Miller from SEH, who served as our consultants for this effort.
Thanks, Brian.
Perfect. Thank you.
The system would never work if not for his effort.
Yeah,
so
that's,
I really
that's for sure.
That.
It wouldn't work with me.
It's just so simple.
What I wanted to do is I'm going to provide a little background on the work we've done, and then I'm going to ask Andy to walk through the results of the work and some recommended next steps. Before I do that, I want to acknowledge two council members who are with us quite frequently along the way. Others stepped in and out, but Councilmember Wojak and Councilmember Hickey were hands-on.
We always agreed. It was awesome.
Many stages of this process, so we appreciate that. I want to acknowledge that. I also want to acknowledge the community group, the stakeholder group, that sort of ad hoc stakeholder group that was organized that represented property owners, neighborhood residents from three neighborhoods, and Mayo Clinic, along with our work with city colleagues on this. So I just want to start with that acknowledgement. You may recall that we outlined a process that would walk us through what was intended to be a 90-day process. Much of it happened in the window of time we set, and then there was a much longer period of time between the design sprint and where we are today. Nevertheless, the outline of that process is on the screen in front of you. I won't go through it. It's in your packet. But we are bringing to you a draft concept that we want to share with you. I mentioned that we work closely with city staff on this initiative. Gary was quite involved, I think more involved with this in the arena.
Yes, probably true.
But one of the things that we talked about in this process was to help distinguish the difference between what this plan really represents, or really what this set of design concepts really, really meant. And Gary advised us on some terminology that would be important to include in the document, and I'll just ask Gary to speak to this.
Well, I think one of the things our staff tries to lay out is when we're adopting something, what it is and what it is not, so that the council knows as they move forward, and basically you can see what it says. It's a vision for the St. Mary's Place District, and it's a tool to support the DMC plan. It is like a concept plan. It is not a master plan that you're adopting saying this is prescriptive, it has to be exactly this way, but it certainly comes up with some, we think, very good ideas that the staff was in agreement with the folks that worked on it on the committee. We're not approving any specific projects, and it's not an appropriation of funds, but it will be, it's essentially a concept plan or a guideline, and we'll try and make as many of these happen as we can as we move forward. And that's kind of the basic description of what it is. Any questions?
Okay. So one of the things that we thought was quite important in this process was the methodology and our investment in, thank you, Mayor, our investment in the community engagement process. There's a lot of stakeholders in this district. It's a very important part of our community. So on this slide, you see that we involved many community members through on-site surveys, intercept surveys, electronic surveys. We went through several refinements, meetings with city staff, public open houses. We were in front of this body, our DMC board, DMCC board, met with Mayo facility staff, and as recently as out in the community during Porch Fest, an annual event in the Kutsky neighborhood, where we used that as an opportunity for a on-site open house, if you will. So this just really outlines our various tools to invite community to give us feedback as this plan went through various iterations. So with that, I'm going to ask Andy to walk through some of the key findings and some of the recommended next steps.
All right, thanks. I do want to say that we did partner with the Minnesota Design Center folks, the same people who work on the urban design guidelines, John Carmody, also were involved early on with the public engagement and through this design process. And so it's good to work with people with such talent. And like Patrick said, we had a very robust public engagement. And it's never enough with public engagement. We've probably done the best we possibly can and very diverse. So through all that, we tried to filter it down to four urban design strategies. And this right here is just sort of the overall plan. And so protected passages. I'm just going to be very brief here, probably 5 or 10 minutes, and leave time for questions. So protected passages, activated connected spaces or places, streets for people, and then district identity for the four key strategies. So one thing that we heard from the business community was weather protection. Very important to them. So we had a lot of discussions. We studied tunnels, different options for tunnels. I know the cities looked at had studies done about tunnels. Costs are enormous for tunnels, and but it also we talked about the pros and cons. The pros, obviously, it gives the ability to get into a hotel and walk into the same areas without putting your coat on, and so much convenient, accessible. The cons are just it sort of robs the activity off the street. We don't have that much density in the area. This isn't downtown Chicago where you can have a subway, street level, and skyway, and it'll all be bustling. I guess through this process, we came upon a solution here where we do have a tunnel, a north-south connection straight into St. Mary's, and this is something that's been vetted with the Mayo Clinic, but then use that in a combination with a continuous arcade. So this idea isn't really new. It's an idea that was in the Second Street Corridor study that was done several years ago. So the idea is, again, you have that weather protection. The arcade would be transparent. It could be well lit, and you could have reheated heat or heated sidewalks. And so it could be some really open and transparent way of getting from your hotels, getting from your street level activity into St. Mary's Hospital. So why don't you go to the next slide? The idea of the tunnel led to. We have access to a tunnel, so we felt that on the north side, why don't we create a courtyard that would be at that level of the tunnel plus at the level of the street. So on the north side, we're just proposing to do an outdoor courtyard that has activity, really an active use. On the south side, on the St. Mary side, the courtyard would be, again, access the tunnel, but also be more passive, similar to the Dan Abrams Healthy Living Center courtyard. So to give you a point of reference, though, this is the edge right here of the Aspen Suites, and this is the edge of the Bay property. So this is Tonic Tins. I don't know if Tins is there right now. So it's sort of an area right now directly right across from the center entrance to St. Mary's. Another, as we talked about, we heard a lot about people really wanted connectedness, and they wanted activity, and we also heard they wanted open spaces, and that's challenging when you have a dense urban environment. So open spaces, to me, means good connection to open space, maybe small plazas, places for people, and we have so many visitors in the area, we need places for people to sit, relax, and socialize outside. So. During our visit a year ago up to St. Paul, we found an area or a street was vacated, and they created an outdoor plaza. So one of the ideas here that was presented to the group and we heard a lot of support for is to block off half of 12th Avenue. This is the Canadian Honker and Caribou. So we would create a plaza. We'd still leave the alleys open on the north side, but shut that down and create an outdoor plaza which could be used as sort of a miniature peace plaza for farmers markets, concerts, large community events. The other concept in terms of activity is the importance of alleys. And here, we heard loud and clear people wanted activity on the street, especially the avenues. And so why we're fortunate enough to have an alley system now, although it's fragmented. But alleys are a great place to put things, your parking, your access to your underground parking or upper level parking, vehicle drop-offs, deliveries, trash, utilities. It's a place for urban environments to put all the things that people, we don't really want people to see. So, and what that does is that frees up the streetscape, the streets for on the avenues and also on Second Street. So we really kind of want to stress the importance of alleys as moving forward. I know there are issues with that. There are some that are, I know we'll talk a little bit more about the alleys and some of the challenges behind that strategy. The other thing, again, in terms of connectivity, people wanted very convenient access to Second Street from both the north and the south. As we studied it, we found out the blocks are very long, five to 600 feet long, and a typical urban block is probably closer to 300 feet. So what this plan or these concepts are proposing are to have a mid-block pedestrian connection in each block to shorten the distance people have to walk. And then we also heard frequent pedestrian crossings was very important to people. Jaywalking is a huge safety problem in the area. And we're proposing, as a part of the new reconstruction plans, crosswalks at 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th, and 16th. And the crossing at St. Mary's would be at subway level only. This is just a kind of a plan view of what that 12th Avenue Plaza could look like. It's just meant to be a flexible space that you could drive in and set up tents and activities, built-in raised planters, which also could act as informal seating and a place for trees. Streets are very important. Right now, as you know, the city is going through a study, I think four infrastructure studies. Transit is one of them, and transit's so important for this area. So transit and also bicycles, there's a lot of debate about bicycles. Should they be on Second? Should they be not on Second? And it was pretty split, and we end up concluding that the bicycle master plan calls for the bicycles to be on First Street Southwest, which is identified as a bicycle boulevard, but you've got to get them over there. So if you're coming across the 52 Bridge, traveling east, this proposal talks about a bike box to get you to turn north and to get over to First. But also, too, as part of one of those studies is this idea of the city loop, and I've heard that one of the options for the city loop is to run down Second Street up to 13th. So our plan does identify that and accommodates that if that potential were to happen.
Test question. Is that supposed to be First Street, not First Avenue on the top? Yeah. Okay, first. Right. Thank you.
Another concept is the idea of tabletop streets. It's something I believe that they also pitched on Peace Plaza on First Avenue. Curbless street where you bring the street up to the sidewalk level. All I can say is that Public Works is studying that idea. There's going to be some reconstruction plans that are going to be happening. People seem to be split on that idea as well. It does make it more accessible. You do have to create some kind of barrier in the form of, say, tree trenches, which allows for a structural soil and trees to take off the stormwater and protect the pedestrians. But and it doesn't have to be necessarily an all or nothing thing, too. It could be just at an intersection as well. All right, connections to the north along 13th Avenue was the obvious one. We heard connections to the north and the south are important. Studying the city loop study kind of confirms what we had came up with is that the connection along 13th Avenue to the north, which leads you directly to Kutsky Park and the city trail system, is an important connection. And then to the south along the green space in front of St. Mary's, which is also the Peace Gardens and up of the Fall neighborhood. The street, the idea of shared streets on some of these avenues is an area, a way to deal with the avenues where the people and the cars share equally. Speeds would be very low based on the design of the street, and allows for more outdoor patios and also potentially on-street parking too. The section that we're working with, I guess the important thing here to talk about is that right now, currently, through the main part is a 66-foot right-of-way. And as we studied this, to the east and to the west, it's 100 feet wide. And so that gives you more flexibility when it comes to transit and street design. So as we studied it, we found out that what happens is the city is asked on the north side, like when the Homewood Suites and the Marriott came along, they asked for an additional 17 feet. And then now when a lattice comes along, and then the city also created the official map 19, where they've created 17 feet on both sides, up to 14th. So we've got 100 feet all the way up to 14th. And we found out that the sidewalk in front of St. Mary's is actually encroaching onto their property by about 8 feet. So I had discussions with Mayo. They seem supportive of the idea of giving up an additional 9 feet, which doesn't sound as bad. So you've got 17 and 17 onto 66. Gives you 100 feet. The design also has to accommodate the fact that some of the hotels on the north side are not going to change anytime soon. So you have to, if the street reconstruction does happen in 2019 or 2020, you have to still accommodate those businesses that aren't planning to move back that additional 17 feet. This is just an example of a shared street. Again, the design of it makes it more plaza-like and meant to slow traffic and an equal place for people and cars on the avenues. The last strategy that we heard was important was creating a unique district identity. Right now, as you exit 52 on the 2nd Street, it's not very appealing. The thought was, how do you create a sense of arrival and off of 52? And you can do that by creating some gateway feature that could be art-related. Think about the west side of 52, the uptown art features, maybe something a little bit larger scale. There is city-owned property and medians that are available. So the thought there would be to book in something not only 52, but then at 11th, so as you're kind of entering this sort of sub-district of St. Mary's Place. And then the other thing is using art in a fashion that could be related to the gateway features and use it in a consistent fashion throughout the district, and doing things like wayfinding and banners and lighting and having a sort of a cohesive streetscape sort of gives it a sense of identity as well. Since this has been completed, we have had a stakeholder meeting. Patrick mentioned a group of stakeholders, and then we've also we also went to this Porch Fest event. So this is just a quick summary of what we heard at that stakeholder meeting. Seems to be support for the tunnel, the idea, and the arcade system. Everybody likes the wide sidewalks, and then there seemed to be support for closing off 12th Avenue. Again, that's something that's not going to be done without the owner agreeing to that. Joe owns both sides of that avenue, so it's something he would have to agree to if that were to move forward. Some of the concerns we heard were the idea of closing off the at-grade sidewalk in front of St. Mary's, speeds of traffic during non-peak times based on this design, left turning movements, the safety involved that, and then the alley systems that are partially vacated now, how viable is that to restore those in the future? At Porch Fest, we heard a lot of people saw this for the very first time. We ended up closing off half of 12th, just north of First Street, and so it was an example of prototyping or testing out that idea. But we did hear a lot of support. People were seeing it for the first time. And so there was, I think, a lot of support for the ideas. Some of the concerns we heard were the timing of the improvements and then, you know, how would they be implemented? And, you know, what is the city committed to those improvements? And where's the money going to come from? And, again, just still feeling safe crossing 2nd Street. Did we do enough to do that?
concepts.
Prototyping ideas, I'm not going to go through these, the idea of testing these ideas out. We have done a bike share event last fall where people in St. Mary's are riding their bikes up and down downtown, and then using this Porch Fest as a plaza where there's live music. It's also kind of examples of testing out these ideas before moving forward with them. And then the final thing, which I want to spend a little time on, is, you know, what's this all going to cost? So this was just an attempt at trying to break down these costs. You know, we do know that the city's going to reconstruct the street, full reconstruction with utilities, and we estimate the cost between $6 and $7 million. I know there's federal funding, obviously, that's going to pay for a portion of that. The north-south tunnel in front of St. Mary's doesn't go directly across because of grade issues. We're estimating the cost there. The 12th Avenue Plaza. Some of the north courtyard is still challenging because of the land costs. The land costs could be extensive in that area, so it's a little fluid based on land costs. And then some of the gateway features and then decorative banners and portable planters are kind of a lower cost immediate than we could do. So, and then phasing, how would you phase something like this? Again, if you want to do something right away, there are things you could do in trying to get district identity, trying to develop some kind of graphics or logo for the area, portable planters, banners that could be hung on existing light poles, benches, wayfinding, or things that could be done right away to generate some excitement for the area to show people that something's happening. But a lot of it's going to happen as development occurs, too. Gateway features, public art is something that could be moved up and happen at an earlier phase. You know, some of these things, the 12th Avenue Plaza would have to be something, again, that the city would have to study. And the courtyards, the South Courtyard would be, a male project, although they've indicated they'd like to have some city support with that, I think. So, I guess with that, I really do want to have a discussion and have questions. And between, I know Mark's got a quick fly through.
Why don't we pause on that?
Okay.
So thank you, Mr. Staver. And this was the report we wanted to provide you. I think you can see considerable progress since we were last here. And what we hope to convey to you is that we have. I think really positioned a direction for St. Mary's Place that isn't intended, as Gary said, to be prescriptive, but really helps position other decisions that are going to be in front of you, like the transit decisions, like future developments. And this becomes a way of thinking about the public space as this progresses. And again, Councilmember Wojak and Councilmember Hickey were hands-on it during the various phases, so you may have comments to add to this as well.
You
want
to start off?
Sure. Yeah, I'll just add the comments that I made kind of at the end of our last meeting. We had kind of the wrap up. You know, the things that I like about this, you've got kind of a palette of options to choose from, but it's not prescriptive. We can choose the things that make sense, and the things that don't, we can we won't select. But and then just the overall concern, as these projects come and go, you've heard my concern that we don't do things that are really going to shut down vehicle traffic that we're still going to need for the foreseeable future. So we have to balance, we want to make it pedestrian friendly and such, but also we need to realize that cars are going to be a big part of what we're doing here for the foreseeable future. So I think striking that balance is going to be important as we go forward, but definitely a lot like from the palette of choices that we saw.
Okay,
I'd say largely I agree with Councilmember Hickey. Just his take on this. We understand that Second Street's one of the major arterials in the community, and it's gonna be four lanes. We're not gonna, how those lanes are utilized might change in the future. But this gives us a nice blank slate to work with, where we have a lot of flexibility out there. And the places we're talking about the enhancements, they're largely out of the way of the major arterials, so that's a little bit easier to get along with. One of the things I like to point out is, we always start out with what we are doing and what we're not doing. And it is super easy to just approve visions because they don't have any teeth to them. And where the rubber's going to meet the road, and I get a direct question to Richard here, is when When do we expect to see some sort of a layout for the Second Street reconstruction?
Probably within the next 90 days.
Yeah. Okay. That's going to be where we really start to make some decisions on this. And what I'm encouraged by and what is really well thought out in this is today the right-of-way, the part that we have control over, is 66 feet. In the future, as projects happen, that may expand to 100, and it may not expand to 100. But this vision shows you what you can do for 66 feet, and it shows you what you can do at 100 feet, and you don't have to do it all at the same time. So that's very good. And I was also supportive of not making the bicycle a primary mode of transit on Second Street, so long as we address the issues of getting bicycles through the area, and the bike box is a good way of doing that. Understanding that, you know, any cyclist that wants to, the rules of the road, they get to ride, and I know there is at least one cyclist in this community that is just dumb enough to ride down Second Street all the time, so I'm not sure if there's two. So that's conceptually very good.
Okay, Mr. Hildeback.
I like it. I like what the fact that they came out with not only phases, but the approximate cost. And I think that's important because I think it's been said a number of times, dollars are going to count and they're going to be short. I do hope, Andy, I like a lot of what you've done, but I hope that you go back and work with the businesses and talk to them about the participation, the pros and cons for them to be a part of that. I think that would be a really important selling point. And also, for the neighborhoods, there's things they can do, too. If you look at Swaddley Park and they do the boulevard sculptures, it's taken time, but they have about 13, 14 different sculptures up in the area now, and that's something that the neighborhood directly participates in, funds with their Arts on the App. And it's a great program, and it's been going for quite some time. So those types of things, I think, are important. Banners are nice, but finding some unique way for that neighborhood to be able to identify itself. Having pedestrian areas for pedestrians to relax and meditate and look back on things are important. Anybody who's had major families who have had issues, you need that nice, quiet, peaceful place to sit. You really don't have that right now outside the St. Mary's Hospital itself, and sometimes you want to get out. So I think that was really neat to see that you put that in, and different options. I mean, I realize, like you say, the property is expensive. It costs to get some of that, but it's important to look at those types of ideas. So overall, I think that you did a very nice job.
Okay, we have Mr. Ruska, then Mr. Campy, and then we'll try to wrap this one up as well.
Richard, I was curious on that, where we talk about expanding to 100 feet. Are we going to do that on the north side or the south side, or is that something that you guys have adopted, or is it part of the plan in the future?
Well, you've adopted an official map to create a 100-foot right-of-way from 16th Avenue to 14th Avenue. That was done in conjunction with the Lattice Project. Mitzi has suggested that maybe instead of officially mapping the rest of the corridor from 14th to 11th, we possibly do it through zoning. It's required a setback on the north side, but the intent is to create a 100-foot right-of-way through there, either by official map and dedication or by zoning the setback requirements.
Right. It would seem right now that the opportunity on the south side would be better with all the developments going on there, the green space that's there and so on. Is that...
Well, it's going to be 17 feet on each side.
So just on each side, not?
Okay.
Both on
the north and the south side.
Okay. So that's being incorporated now into the Lattice Project? And
yes.
And St. Mary's is aware of that with the new planning of the tunnel and everything?
Yep. And the Marriott and the Homewood Suites already are set back that dimension. So it's the process has been moving forward, and we're attempting to formalize it a little bit more, possibly through a zoning code requirement.
Okay, good. And then I'd just say... presentation's good. That prototyping stuff, I think, could go. I don't think it's really appropriate with this kind of a plan, but that's just my opinion.
Let's go with Mr. Camp and then Mr. Wojcik.
So, I think the saying is it's easy to do nothing sometimes, and I look at this and I think I just want to reiterate for the council that I don't think there's any development that's going to happen in this area that's not going to be TIF supported. They're going to be coming back looking for TIF. So the teeth here to enforce the vision is selectively allowing TIF utilization. Mm-hmm. Until we step up and we say no to a TIF request, then this has no teeth. Because if they come through with a proposal that doesn't meet this and we say yes, that is the opportunity that is missed to have teeth. And I will say that there was some consternation about whether or not this would apply to people who are making plans right now to do development. Our city attorney's office has agreed that unequivocally it would. So I think it's a good time as people are starting to consider projects to get this out there. And frankly, to have this council draw a line in the sand that says, yes, it is a vision document. Yes, it's easy to pass vision documents because they don't seem binding. But be aware that if you are coming for TIF, this is the vision. It's not whatever you want now. It's in order to get TIF, you will do what this vision shows. Because that is why we do these plans. So again, it's easy to sit here and say you like it or you don't like it. I think the true test is that first project that doesn't adhere to it in a meaningful way and being willing to say no. And so, you know, again, reiterate for the council, I know that we don't say no oft, but important kind of to realize that that's where the teeth are.
Mr. Wojcik.
Well, and I'd say not only TIF, but also incentive and restricted development gives us the exact same ability to negotiate in the public interest. And I could be wrong, but I don't believe we will ever see a proposal in this portion of the corridor that will not come looking for incentive, restricted, or TIF. So we can execute on our vision for certain, and it's for the public good that we do that. Second part, just wanted to respond a little bit to the prototyping. There are certain things that you would not want to prototype, like massive transportation use changes. When we're talking about doing things on, you know, avenues that are very very low traffic volume, or you know, pedestrian ways, or even doing things like painting a bike box and that sort of thing, those are outstanding ways to do prototyping because you don't spend a lot of money and you get to see if people will actually use it. And you know, a lot of communities are doing it. And the biggest reason why I support prototyping in most cases is just people are doing it all over the country right now, and it works, and it gets good results, and it gives you a data set that you wouldn't otherwise have. So I'd be careful not to throw out the prototyping altogether, understanding we're not going to restripe Second Street as a prototype either.
All right. One question I have for staff. So, and some of the next steps are outlined here, but more definitively, what would be the next step to bring this forward?
Well, I think we'd have you endorse or approve this as a concept plan for this area. I think the same thing should probably go through the DMCC board. I think they had some involvement in this. And then basically you have a guideline then to use when people come forward. Some of the, you know, there's some very good things that came out of this, such as the tunnel, the additional right-of-way, the arcade idea. There's a lot of good ideas. There's some others that will require some additional steps, but you will, as Nick said, you'll have it here for every developer that comes forward, and then you get into the process and start discussing and negotiating projects.
So, I see a lot of hands, but I just wanted to be more specific. Would you envision that comes forward to the council in the form of maybe a public hearing, so that people can weigh in with their comments, or what are you thinking?
I think it's more, I mean, we've had, you know, this project has had probably more engagement than anyone I can recall. I mean, the last stakeholder meeting we had, I think, all of the parties in the neighborhood and the businesses represented. So my thought would be the council would, however you want to do it. I mean, if you want a hearing on it, you can. I don't see a particular need for it at this point. It's been discussed a lot. And I would just hope you would adopt it and put it kind of on the books as the concept plan for this area.
Okay. I have Mr. Bildebeck, Mr. Campy, Mr.
Gary, just want to follow up. If this is accepted by the council, will you make sure that when the developers come in with a plan for a planning meeting, that they also see this and they understand?
I mean,
it's similar expectations.
I view this similar to the design guidelines. I mean, both the planning staff, our office, the public works staff has this as, like the design guidelines, has a document to work from when we discuss with the
developers. Right. I think that goes back to Nick's point. It's important for the people to see the expectations. And if they see this, if the council adopts this and it goes, you have your planning meeting the first day, they ought to see this and they understand what's expected.
So it's similar like what we've done with the design guidelines. We've shipped that out to multiple developers already for projects that they're involved with.
Okay, Mr. Campion?
Yeah, and to Mark, to Mr. Councilmember Bilderback's point, I think additionally us being robust in our kind of appreciation of the document and affirmation of its points. So if we're not generally in agreement that it's not the arcade, it's the inner kind of corridor passage, what do we call that? The inside the building. It's like the alley, but it's
atrium.
The what?
Atrium.
the atrium walk or whatever that goes spans down where we don't have the right of way, if that's critical to us, then that's one of our points we need to make sure staff are aware of when they come up there and say, you know, we won't support other developments. That isn't what I intended to ask about. What I intended to ask about was the DMCDA's position relative to developers, and particularly we got a letter from Mr. Bay. I'm wondering if you have a response relative to the DMCDA's position on how they'll be accessing and leveraging, and what kind of response would be to that.
Yeah, Mr. Campion, I would say that like the design guidelines, this is a tool that helps provide direction up front to developers about the kind of city we want to see developed and the resources that would come from public sources like DMC we would want to be reflected in a vision like this. But as you can imagine, as a project comes forward, it will be negotiated. There will be an iterative process. Their designers might have a better solution to achieve what we're after, and that would be welcome, but it's a starting point. And so that's how we would use it as a direction that this is what we hope to achieve, this is what the community hopes to achieve. And I'll just use as an example, somebody asked Mr. Freeze about the timing of Second Street redesign. Their designers, as an example, reached out to us and said, can we have the most current work, because we are now going to begin the design of Second Street and we would like to have the benefit of this in our design process. So they're one of your own developers. Think of it that way. You can hold accountable to this perfect same way.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Wojcik.
This is a comment. The arcade system is a fantastic outcome of this, because everybody wanted tunnels everywhere. And then everybody saw what the price tag was for tunnels everywhere. And all of a sudden, nobody wanted tunnels anymore because nobody wanted to pay it. And this is something that gets you to 90% of the solution at 10% of the cost. And that's feasible in this corridor. Tunnels everywhere, as it turns out, definitely were not. I want to be very specific to what I would like to see happen for this, is that you know, have it be adopted as a plan addendum to the comprehensive plan that we do sometimes. Same way we did the design guidelines. Have it go to planning and zoning. Have it go to us. Have it go to DMC, so there's that formal stamp of approval, and we can proceed in 90 days with the next part.
All right. Any final comments?
Thank you.
Good presentation. Thank you.
Thanks.
Moving on to our final topic for this afternoon is developing a process for determining if infrastructure is public or private.
I need a staff person to project for me. And Mr. Spenby, Mr. Digber, never a word about my inability to open that other USB drive.
That probably makes sense.
Now, as he's setting up, I'll just a little bit of a background on what this is and why this is important to me. And at this point, this is purely a conceptual activity. But what I did do is I'm going to run through some facts, opinions, analysis. And I do want to say that the facts section, I worked with Mr. Freeze in Public Works just to make sure that my facts were, in fact, facts, and that the opinions were just that. Because if we don't have an agreement on where the starting point is, what the facts are, everything after that is completely dead. There's no particular outcome on this other than I would like to see us move in the direction of actually putting a plan in place which is going to get us to the point where we begin to address this massive unfunded liability we have as a community. And this isn't a Rochester unique thing, but what's unique is that we are the body that's responsible for Rochester. So I'm just not content not doing anything, which is kind of what I feel that the process has been. Obviously, all this will be made available to everybody as well. I just wanted to confirm the facts with Mr. Freeze before we sent out anything. So go ahead and jump to the next one. We're really struggling financially with a lot of our plans. We've got a staffing plans, capital improvement plan, parks master plan. We don't have the appropriate funding in there to do any of it. And I put a question mark after the public transportation plan because we have a really nice 5-year plan, and we will see when the budget comes out whether we're putting sufficient resources in there to actually fund that plan. I sure hope we are, but until then, it's a question mark. And we're not able to fully fund our major maintenance right now, whether it's streets or our facilities or our park maintenance, and it's a real problem. So the next set of facts. Our growth pattern is far less compact than under other 100,000 K-plus cities. You can look, we're actually about the same geographic size as Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Rochester. The difference is they've got 3 or 4 times as many taxpayers and a much larger economy paying for all their infrastructure. All things being equal, we're going to be taxed at a much higher rate than them, and right now we're actually taxed at a much lower rate than them. So go ahead and jump to the next one. And so we have this enormous unfunded liability in street infrastructure. In 2016, Public Works presented just how big it was. Annually, more than $20 million shortfall, what we should be doing in road maintenance versus what we are. And then the total unfunded liability, when you factor in everything, what's been deferred up to this point and what we have going forward, $1.4 billion. That's a really big, scary number. In 2016, this report, this has been kind of one of my pet things since 2008 when I first started annoying all of you. And in 2016, we finally got that report that specified what the magnitude of the problem was. And I hope that that would spur some movement towards coming up with a solution, but to date it hasn't happened. On April 4th, Quenneville sent out a memo basically saying that they were not interested in taking any action until we adopted the figures, and that staff must be, and the staff needs to be directed by the council to come up with a plan. So let's jump to the next one. The problem's not all are doing. We cannot charge fair assessments to adjoining property owners by state law. This problem has been in place for 40 years, as the math was quickly done on the spot in the last meeting, and we really haven't made any progress in addressing this issue. The major roads, we're using the state aid funds to address that, so the major roads, at least there's kind of a source there that we're using for it. But most roads are just maintained by property taxes, and we can't change property taxes to reward places that are more efficient and punish places that are less efficient, and we can't... There are so many properties that rely on this road but provide absolutely no funding to maintain it. You know, pretty much figure any nonprofit in the city of Rochester, they may be consuming a lot of road infrastructure relying on it, but they're not contributing to the maintenance of it. And then, residential property taxes seldom cover operating costs for city services. I want to say never, but there's probably some cases where it potentially does, but it's exceedingly rare. And that because they're not covering even the operating costs for the city, they're not paying anything down towards the capital maintenance of these roads. So residential areas in particular are a huge money loser for us. And the last set of facts, since 2016, since we got this data, we're making the issue worse. We still have the multi-source garbage hauling, fully understanding that decreases the life of our roads. We've added more roads without considering funding impacts. We made no progress in funding the shortfall in the 2017 budget, and I'm going to go out on a limb and say we ain't going to make any progress in the 2018 budget either. There's just no money there for it.
Right.
We're not pursuing non-tax fee revenue, which is an option, never going to be popular, but we got to pay our bills. And then one thing I did want to point out, it's not that we haven't done nothing, it's just the one thing we have done is we've put requirements in place that are ensuring higher quality road construction, which only gets us to the conservative case where we have the $1.4 billion debt. As soon as you assume poor road maintenance, then you don't, that 1.4 gets even bigger. And what we don't want is we don't want another Shops on Main. So we failed to address the issue to date. Solutions are going to require us to change and actually do something. And I put 5 things up here, and it could be a combination of all these things, but we need to do something. Spend more on road maintenance. Not popular. That's higher taxes, more fees, more assessments. Have less roads to maintain. Vacating roadways, not popular. Only accept public roads that are likely to generate more revenue than expense. That's an incremental step that can be done. increase the density of tax base, which is something that we can be doing, but a lot of times we're approving very low tax use and tax generating properties in some very prime locations. Look at some of the stuff we've approved on Broadway, Civic Center Drive, some of those places. And then we can also reduce the current level of maintenance. And one thing all these things have in common is they're all unpopular one way or another. Go ahead and jump to the next one. So what I want to show you is just kind of layouts of three different neighborhoods. And you can't see it very well. When you get the digital copy, it'll be a little bit clearer. But there's three kinds of roadways. Basically, there's the major state aid ones, which are funded by our municipal state aid. And that's done in black here. So the major roadways, and this happens to be Kutzke Park, 2nd Street, the Highway 52 and Frontage Road, 16th Avenue, 11th Avenue, 6th Avenue, Center Street. These are all municipal state aid streets. Those are kind of in a different bucket by themselves because they're a community-wide asset. There's ones that you can't see on there that are green, and that's typically the alleyways. And what green means is it's either a private roadway or we're treating it like a private roadway. Our alleys, pretty much it's paid for by the owners or it doesn't get done. As a result, it's just not getting done. And then the yellow ones are, in order to support this neighborhood, here's the level of neighborhood streets that are required. So you can see there in every neighborhood, there's going to be some neighborhood-type streets. And this includes my favorite Whipping Boy, which is the cul-de-sacs. But this includes a lot of local streets. And the key thing about this is looking at the tax valuations and generation from Kutzke Park, this neighborhood generates far more in tax capacity than it consumes. And that's largely because of the mix of businesses that are in the neighborhood. This is also, of the three neighborhoods we look at, it's the smallest, but it has the highest population, and it has the best financial return on investment. So let's jump to the next one. Fox Hill, that's where yours truly lives. As this neighborhood is developed, there are a number of private roads, private cul-de-sacs, private streets that go through there. And tremendous density up there. It's actually one of the more dense new developments that have been done in the last 20, 25 years. This includes the Fox Hill area, which is dense, Orchard Hills Villas, Fox Valley Villas, and then the new ones in the Fox Hill area as well. This is probably the densest, high-value portion anywhere in Rochester, and we probably still don't pay the cost of our roads. We're still losing up here, but it's much, much more efficient than what most of the suburban growth has been in Rochester. So let's jump to the last one. Here we have Hart Farms, and purely random that I'm picking on this one, because there's 20 neighborhoods that look exactly like this. But what you'll see is you do have the major arterials on, I think it's 18th and 40th. But the key thing here is every single street in this area is a public street. The density is far lower, and as a result, the tax generation per acre is substantially lower. And as this problem has grown, this is the style of development that we've been doing more and more, and it makes us less efficient. So let's jump to the next one. So here's my opinion. We don't need to do anything right now, but we do need to develop a plan. And because I was challenged that we need to formally adopt public works staff analysis and figures, let's take that step. Let's adopt the figures that that Richard provided for us in 2016 and updated in 2017, so we have a point which we're working from, a common understanding. The second thing would be then to formally direct administration and finance staff, because one thing Richard doesn't do is taxation, to come up with a long-term strategic plan to address the unfunded liability. We ain't going to solve this thing in 1 year, we ain't going to solve it in 5 years, and we probably ain't going to solve it in 20 years, but from 2016 to 2017, we went backwards. So let's have that formal direction up there that we do need to develop a plan to address this, and that's what I'm really pushing for. I want to see that plan in place. I want to see the plan voted on, adopted, and followed. The unfunded liability figure that comes from Public Works and our plan, we should be reviewing this on an annual basis as part of our budget cycle to make sure we're headed in the right direction. Right now, it's not something that's not a part of our formal process. And then lastly, what this is somebody, staff or developer, must give us, we've got to get some sort of financial analysis on proposed new public infrastructure to just understand what we're doing, how we're affecting the big picture. we can we should include the annualized capital maintenance cost, include an estimate of what the new tax receipts are going to be from it. Staff should give us some indication of what is this going to do to our unfunded liability, what would policies do to our unfunded liability. You know, and lastly, we should have a council vote when we go to accept new road infrastructure, because right now it's just kind of, the lines are blurred, and it's part of the GDP maybe preliminary plat. But at some point, we got to have a formal decision whether or not the council votes that it's a priority of the public funds to create some of this infrastructure, particularly the money-losing infrastructure. I've got one last one. We also need a policy to ensure that public alleys will be funded and maintained in the same manner as other residential streets. It's to me, it's the neighborhoods that are the most financially stable and sustainable in the community are really suffering from badly deteriorated alleyways, and it's because we put 100% of the cost of all maintenance on them. And if at the same time we're going to be funding 650 cul-de-sacs, which largely provide benefit just to individual households, we should at least be some fair with their alley. So there's a lot in here, and I fully expect that everyone will want to digest it a little bit. But I think the big picture for me is that we need to formally accept what the situation is, and we need to formally direct staff to make a plan. And, you know, I thought this was intuitive from the 2016 data that was brought for us, but, you know, we all saw that memo on from Quenvold on April 4th, and it's not been intuitive. We actually need to provide some direction, and I think that if nothing else, it keeps us all in the same place where we may disagree with what the path is going forward, but at least the magnitude of the problem and the process we can settle on. That's my intent. Not asking for any formal action today, but just am asking for folks to take a look at this and give feedback and possibly bring this up for council action at a future meeting.
Mr. Newman.
Yeah, can I speak for some perspective? Yeah. There's a lot of things in what Michael has here that I agree with. I would point out, though, that I think this is, in the big picture, his conclusion that you need to focus on individual street types and say that is your solution.
I didn't put that in here for a reason.
Well, it ends up, you're focusing something that will never get you there, because the issue is none of our developments will pay for the streets they have, because in the end of the day, you cannot pay for the reconstruction of that street. That's where the issue is. Because of the fact that, unfortunately, the state doesn't give cities any options to address this. And it was not always that way. That's the point I'm pointing out. Because, as Michael said, I was working on this way before he was even around, so I'm about the only one who remembers this. If you go back to I wouldn't say I was here in the 60s, but until about the mid-80s, this really wasn't an issue. In the mid-70s, there were some court cases and some legislation that came up, and I hate to repeat this, but it gives me the main point here, is this didn't exist. Cities assess for 100% of the residential street costs and the commercial street costs. Cities were not trying to pay for these roads out of the property taxes. There is not room in the property tax to pay for this reconstruction volume of streets, especially since the huge volumes of streets came here in big chunks, I mean, all at one time. But it's going to hit other cities. All the suburbs are going to run into this as well. Michael, you mentioned Minneapolis and St. Paul have a greater density, and that solves it for them. It doesn't. Minneapolis has got a multi-$100 million deficit, which is where we are currently. We're not at $1.4 billion right now. That's a 60-year, 50-year projection in what you're saying. St. Paul did a different situation. They charged a fee to people for their roadways, a large fee, and they've been doing it for years until a court overturned it this year and said it is a tax. And so they now increase their property. They now are saying to people, we're going to increase our property tax levy 23%, but don't worry about it as much because we already were charging you a lot of that with this fee we were charging. Well, that's something that other cities said, we can't do that, so we're not going, they didn't do it. And so you don't have the excuse to say we already were charging you for something that was really a tax. At the end of the day, this gets back to the fact that the state gives cities no options to fully assess the cost for streets. We get, what, Richard, 25, 35% of our costs we can assess?
20 to 25.
Right. And as I said, in the past, you could assess 100% of it. I would point out that in the era from 2000 to 2010, there were 7 years with levy limits. How would you have even had a possibility of increasing the property tax levy for these roadways? You wouldn't have even had it. To me, the solution, and the engineers have been saying it for years, and the city administrators and managers have been saying it for years, is we need options. And there has been bills that have been introduced to the legislature, and they can't get through. Things such as street utilities, that is one option. I mean, we don't have the same issue with sewer and water and electric and stormwater because you have utilities, and you charge fees for those, you collect funds, you can do advanced planning, you can do appropriate maintenance to extend the life of your utilities because you have those utilities. You don't have it for streets, and you can't assess for the cost. So a street utility would address it. I've discussed it with Senator Senjum, as David would mention here. There's another approach, which would be to change the assessment policies in the state, to go back closer to what they were in the past and what other states do, where you don't have to show an actual increase in value to the property for what you put in there. How are you going to get an appraiser, for example, and this works for sewers and water because we have a source to pay for it, how would you get an appraiser to look at that house and say, you got a new sewer or an old sewer, it's going to decrease your value by $5,000? They're never going to consider it. You got the same thing if you got potholes in your street. An appraiser is not going to say, that increases your value by $10,000. Yes, the city can assess you $10,000 for that. So to my mind, there are several options the state can do. One is change their assessment policy. Two is get a street utility. You could get sales tax options like the county does for transit or transportation purposes. They've got a wheelage tax. They've got a quarter cent sales tax. Those all would help. You know, at this point, a lot of the cities are saying, we need more state money for roads. Well, frankly, you aren't going to get enough to address this from that. You really need one of these other options. I mean, it would help to have more state money for roads. But if they're not going to give you a lot more money for state roads, you need some tools to address the reconstruction of streets. Bear in mind, and I'm preaching here, but the developer puts in the street, he builds it. You don't pay for it. He puts in the sewer and water. You know, they do that. The issue is when you got to reconstruct them. When you reconstruct the sewer and water mains, you have a utility to do it with. You don't have to assess it because you would never collect on that assessment. You couldn't get it passed. You don't have that funding source for streets. That's what makes them different. But some of the things Michael's saying, I'm not in at all disagreement with. But you aren't going to get there by looking at if you do a more high-density development, it's going to pay for the street. It won't, because you still can't assess it. You're not going to be able to increase your property tax to pay for it, because your property tax is going for all the other services of the city. The cities of the state need to get together and get some options on the state level, or you will never address it. It's the same issue in Duluth, St. Paul, Minneapolis, Rochester, and the other cities don't know it yet, but it's going to hit them as well.
Okay, we had several hands up. Could Mr. Hickey next?
Yeah, so... I don't disagree that we have a problem, but before we all agree on an absolute number, one of the fundamental underpinnings of your argument was the full reconstruction of every street every 50 years. And as you recall, when Mr. Fries briefed us, that now with a process of mill and overlay, it's possible, unless there's an underlying failure of the roadbed, that we may be able to preserve these streets in perpetuity with a mill and overlay. At this point, I think the jury's still out on that, but that changes the numbers dramatically from a mill and overlay to a complete reconstruction of every single street in the city every 50 years. So I just don't want to get too focused in on a specific number. I agree there's a problem, but that changes the equation dramatically.
Okay, I want to go to Mr. Fries.
I just want to correct Mr. Hickey. I said that the mill and overlay allowed us to get from 20 to 50. Because originally streets are designed for 20 years, and only with the maintenance do you get to 50.
What happens after 50?
Basically, then you basically have worn out. The crown is so high in the street that you basically have to go back and reconstruct. The curb is better shot. So what you described was how we got from 20 to 50, because 20 years ago we designed the street for the last 20 years. Now we have to design the last 50 years and get that.
Mr. Campion?
I had these high hopes that when we
city administrator Reimer came in, he would come bearing a solution to this problem.
Spent 2 hours.
Now. Right. I mean, you've been studying this for several dozen minutes. No, my point is, can we go back a slide? Here, something low cost to the city that can be done that I like here is making the developer provide an analysis of the fiscal responsibility of a particular roadway. And I think Public Works could generate it. And again, I've asked before, I know that we're not going to solve the problem. Certainly, that's right. That's true. But not being able to end a disease doesn't keep us from inoculating against it. So when I look now and I say, we could put a measure of the financial reasonableness of a roadway into our packet to consider as part of our evaluation of a particular development. To me, that's a no-nonsense, simple thing to do, to say, let's go look at this. How many square feet of roadway are we adding per residence?
Public Works could do that. I don't know if you need to ask the developer to do it. At the end of the day, if you can assess the street, it doesn't make any difference. If you could assess it back to them, it wouldn't make any difference. But if you're looking for information, I think Public Works probably would be the
I think you're right. You're right for today. That we can assess it. The problem is I can envision a future where the state will be under an absolute requirement to give us new tools because every community will be failing. And so I look and I go, beyond that, that problem isn't worth me fighting because sooner or later their hands are going to be pushed and we're not going to have any way to do it. And then I'm going to go, okay, great, we got that tool. Everyone's sad because everyone's being assessed. I get it. But now what have we been doing to fix the problem for the future generation, maybe when I'm ready to retire or something like that. But I think, ultimately, we don't hurt ourselves by only accepting more efficient infrastructure and more efficient kind of neighborhood design. That doesn't hurt our situation. Being more efficient helps.
Mr. Bilbao, I agree with the fact that we should have the numbers to be more efficient, but I also agree that we need to start trying to figure a way to chip away at it from our end. The state is going to take them a period of time before they get to the realize that they need to do something. And even with the senator here, I will say that the state legislature has not shown a whole lot of ability to get things done lately, especially to help us on roads. But I do think the fact is, if we want to sit here and think that we got to wait for the state to get ready to help us, that's only going to put us a lot further behind. We need to do something to start working the other direction. It may not be the total cure, we do have to try to help minimize what we're putting the city in for.
All right, Mr.
Can I just say, I would say this, the state organization to which you pay several $100,000 a year, I think, which would be a part of it, has casually brought this message forward. As I recall, the nonprofits were pretty hard on it a couple of years ago. But it doesn't come to the legislature with a high priority.
I agree with Dave 100%. I think, I don't know what the reason is, but I think it's because it's really the four first-class cities are the ones saying we have this big problem. And the remainder of the cities, they don't see it yet. But it needs to be a priority of the League of Cities organization. I agree 100% with David. It hasn't been pushed hard enough, and we haven't pushed it hard enough either. I mean, it really is to the point where I think cities need to make it the top priority, and we say this is a really big deal.
The League of Cities is respected. If they come over there with a top priority, and this is one of them, it will be recognized and listened to by 201 legislators. No question about it.
All right, Mr. Wood.
It's a very silent message.
Build
a
back.
So a couple of things that I would add, and first of all, personally, thank you for being here to hear the message, and I'm more than happy to provide you any of this information. Come up to St. Paul.
I took pictures of it.
I would get you a better copy even, but I appreciate the tech-savvy stuff. In what Gary and I disagreed with, I deliberately left pretty much all of it, not all of it, but pretty much all of it out of this report. I did not make cul-de-sacs a whipping boy in this, because cul-de-sacs are the symptom, not the disease. And they're an example of financially insolvent infrastructure. What I want to do is I want to focus on the process. And I'm not even going, well, I'm not going to disagree that hard with Mr. Hickey right here and just say that I agree. We can take a look at the numbers and what goes into the numbers, but actually even a focusing on perpetual mill and overlays, which I think the it won't work, but even looking at that, we still create a problem that the magnitude of which is much higher than anything else we face financially in the city. All the more reason to go forward, at least as a starting point, and fine-tune these things as we go. I can't agree with the waiting on the state. I mean, I'm going to go with your original numbers just from the mid-70s when this became a problem. And 40 years, we've seen no movement. And we're not seeing movement right now. So if the state can give us new tools, and that'll help us in the future, but we still have to get our house in the order. And it's true that we will never make residential areas self-sufficient in terms of taxes. However, if they become mixed income, but mixed use, many of them actually do become financially sustainable at that point. And that's something that we haven't talked about nearly as much, but that's further down the road. I just want step one and step two, acceptance and planning at this point. I guess the last thing is there's so much information here, and again, I'm going to make this available for everyone to see. I completely agree. We need to prioritize this, and I go so far, Gary doesn't agree with me on this, but any of our organizations that we fund that as members, if they're not willing to prioritize this, let's ditch them and put our funding into a private lobbyist to carry this for us. It's going to do us more good that way. It really does need to be elevated. And last thought, 10 years, I haven't given up on this. This is my white whale. And I'm not going to give up on this. This is a big problem today. In the future, it destroys our ability to do public safety. It destroys our ability to do parks, libraries, transit, affordable housing. Everything a community might need to do gets eaten up by the enormous magnitude of this problem. So I'm pushing for progress.
All right. Any other final comments?
I just want to make sure that Michael gets that to the city administrator so we can get that handed out to everybody.
Yep.
As well as I'm asking Richard for the 2016 numbers that you had. Really, for Ann Lisa's sake, that she wasn't here, that you can redistribute that all to all of us so that we can have that fresh in our heads, as well as the city administrator so that he gets to look at it as well.
And so
we have it.
We know it very well.
Just one measure. All right, any final comments to wrap up? So we're going to get some additional information. All right, anything else for this afternoon?
Thank you.
And we are adjourned. Thank you.
So what'd you think? I'm sure they had you all ready to be ready to fly right back to California.